Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Today we continue our series of conversations with the candidates who are campaigning to become Oklahoma's 28th governor. Yesterday we spoke with Democratic nominee Drew Edmondson. Today my guest is Libertarian nominee Chris Powell. We've also made numerous attempts to speak with Republican nominee Kevin Stitt. We have yet to receive a response. My guest today, Chris Powell, grew up in Choctaw, Oklahoma. He's a veteran serving in the Marine Corps Reserves and served in the first Gulf War. He's a former state chairman of the Libertarian Party, serving from 2003 to 2005, and he's previously run for public office as a state legislator, an Oklahoma City Council member, and for the county clerk of Oklahoma County. In that race, he received 89,000 votes, which makes him the top vote-getting Libertarian candidate in state history. Powell has served as a dispatcher for the Oklahoma City Police Department. He's currently assigned to their Evidence Management Unit. He joins us today here on Studio Tulsa. Chris Powell, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me on the show.
First of all, if you were elected as the next governor, what would be your first and top priority to accomplish? What would drive you as an elected governor?
Well, I think the people of the state, by and large, have been pretty clear that they think education is the top priority. So I think we're going to try to work on that. My vision involves reducing the political control at the state capitol and increasing authority and responsibility at the local level so that we can empower teachers and parents. So that's what I'm going to focus on. And of course, there's a lot of work to be done as far as looking at funding and changing some of the things with funding, both as far as increases and making it so that it runs more efficiently. There's over 50 different revenue streams into education, and some of those are restricted in what you can do with them. So there's a lot of work to be done to streamline and make the whole thing more efficient. And like I said, my priority is going to be empowering the local communities to control their schools so that we can have people who are actually involved in the process in the classroom, the student, the teacher, and the parent, so that they can have more control over the decision-making process so that we can have better outcomes for our students.
Where do you see the state government overreaching into what you consider to be a local educational matter?
Well, if you go back to House Bill 1017 back in 1990, which was passed after a teacher walkout at that time, there were a number of things in that that teachers were wanting. Part of it was funding, smaller class sizes, things like that. But there were a couple of things that were in there that were put in there as part of the compromise package, two of which I think are really problematic, and that is putting testing and curricula at the state capitol. So you've got what the legislature and the governor acting like a 150-member super school board to decide these things in a one-size-fits-all manner for every student in the state. Well, the kids in Big Cabin are not the same as the kids in Bartlesville or at Booker T. or at Bokoshi. These students are individuals. They have individual needs, and you can't have that one-size-fits-all model that works for everybody. So we need to roll back those things and put it back in the state level. And I'm sure just about everybody is listening has heard about the terrors of the test as far as both teaching to it and the amount of pressure that we put on kids in the classroom for this test. Testing is not education. Testing is something that we can do to measure, but it needs to be the people who are actually there and involved in it that are understanding what it is that we're trying to test and designing those tests to fit those needs.
As you well know, a lot of federal dollars comes into the state for education as well. Would that be endangering that because there are federal testing mandates as well?
Well, it is certainly the case that all of our schools are reliant on federal funds, and there are testing requirements that come along with that. It's hard for a state government to fix that, but we can fix what the state government does and go from there to see what we can do. If you talk to a lot of superintendents, particularly if you talk to them privately, they will tell you that a lot of that federal money is very close to being more trouble than it's worth. If we can get the state control out of the way, then perhaps we can go from there with some of our superintendents to empower them to be into a position where they can really take a hard look at some of that and maybe consider not accepting some of that federal money in order to have more control at the local level within reach of parents and teachers.
Now, you mentioned a couple things, and you mentioned the idea of the testing regimen coming from Oklahoma City out to various school districts. Is there another thing that you see as problematic?
Well, you also have curricular control, and the amount of funding for education. It's the largest part of the state budget. It's over half of the total. And the more funding that you have coming from the state, in my view, the harder it is for the local district to feel empowered to do things that they think are the right thing for the students in their classroom. So moving more of the funding to the local level where we can and as we can, I think, is very important. One way to do this would be to eliminate TIF districts, tax increment financing districts, which that is a specific area, small area, where taxation, local taxation, ad valorem and sales tax and things like that are not sent to their normal recipients, but instead put back into businesses within those districts. It's supposed to be for economic development, but typically all it does is serve as a way to poach jobs from surrounding communities, and at the same time, it robs your municipal government, your county government, and your school districts. And because school districts, they have their funding go through the state equalization board to equalize funding across the state, essentially, every taxpayer helps subsidize TIF districts no matter where they are. I'll give you some examples. I live in the Oklahoma City area. I'll give you some examples from down here. The Devon Tower is a TIF district. The Skirvin Hotel is a TIF district. The Boathouse District is a TIF district. That takes funds directly out of Oklahoma City public school systems, the system that is made up by the state equalization fund, but it reduces the overall amount in the pie to help support our schools statewide. If we were to eliminate TIFs, we would have more local funding. We would have more in the state equalization fund to spread around to the places that need some help to be brought up to the state standard as funding. And we would get rid of some economic development that really doesn't develop anything and gets in the way more than anything else.
We'll talk a little bit more about tax incentives in a moment, but I want to just get a sense of what you believe the next steps for education in the state need to be after the pay raise. I know teachers are advocating for more money going into the classroom. Is this a big priority for you as well?
Oh, I think the next budget is going to have an increase for education funding. We not only have some additional revenues coming in from economic growth that's occurred. Ken Miller is in the state treasurer has indicated we have more revenue than we've had, so we have some more money to spend. I would also look at eliminating some of the corporate welfare and things like that in incentives and special interest spending and tax breaks and things like that, so that we would can migrate that over into core services such as education. The teacher walkout, a lot of the focus got put on pay, but I think if you actually talk to teachers, part of it is funding and part of it is their frustration with the constraints that they have to work under in the classroom. So there's a lot more going on, and I think increasing funding is definitely something that is going to have to happen.
Well, you've mentioned budget and taxes issues several times, as a libertarian usually does. So let's go ahead and talk about that, sir. No, libertarians usually are looking for the lowest level of taxation to support a philosophical set of core services. I think that's one of the core tenets of libertarianism. So what's your feeling about the state's taxation level? Too high, too low, or about right?
Well, I naturally do want to have taxation at the lowest level possible. I would be happy to look at decreasing the rates that we have, but I don't think that we're in a climate that is favorable for that now. If you look to our neighbors to the north in Kansas, you had a program of reducing taxation that didn't include reducing spending along with it. And eventually that caught up with them and they really got in a bind and now they are back to raising taxes again. My approach is to as far as those issues is to move slowly and cautiously in the direction that we want to go by building consensus. Let's find the places where we can cut spending, where we don't need to be using the taxpayer dollar. And then going forward from there to lower the rates of taxation after we've lowered the spending. If you lower taxation first and don't fix your spending issues, then you're going to wind up back where you started, only worse off. So that's not my approach. My approach is to cut the spending first.
Let me ask you about incentives. You've mentioned that a couple times in our conversations so far. Give us some examples of tax incentives you feel like shouldn't be there, and from your philosophical viewpoint, that it could actually help lower rates down the road, but the idea of adding more revenue now through the elimination of some of the incentives. What incentives would you be looking at?
Well, there's a number of different things that are before the Incentive Evaluation Commission that we could look at. Things like the film subsidy, where we will pay movie companies to come here and pay them millions of dollars to make movies that often don't put us in a very good light. There's the out at Burns Flat, the spaceport sales tax exemption that's still on the books. There's things like, well, the gross production tax, with it having the lower rate for the hydraulic fracking, the
horizontal drilling,
and things like that. In my view, energy production, regardless of how it's accomplished, we should have that to be as close to the same rate for any kind of energy production from day one forward across the board. If you're going to drill a well or erect a wind turbine or build a solar farm or even dig a coal mine, it should be because it makes economic sense, not because you're getting a tax benefit out of it. So I think we could do that. I want the tax equality. I don't necessarily want the revenue. But I think as part of that, if you were to do that, you would probably have a revenue increase to be able to get it through the legislature. But tax equality to put everybody on a level playing field is very important to me.
Let me ask you, philosophically, how do you talk about that when you have a family making $40,000 a year versus an energy executive that's making $5 million a year? Should they be paying that same 5% tax, income tax? Should they be paying an overall tax rate that affects them equally as far as their percentage of their income?
Well, I would say that because of bracket creep, which you're going to have with any kind of progressive income tax system, we've wound up in the situation that we have, just as you described, where essentially we have a flat tax on the income tax. That's the practical result of it. And I think that's fine. Now, if we want to adjust the exemptions to assist people who are on the lower end of the economic ladder, then I don't have a problem with that. But the way that we've worked out with bracket creep, where we've essentially eliminated the different brackets, I think is a step in the right direction as far as tax equality and the way to adjust that for people who are, like I said, on the lower end of the scale there. Looking at the personal exemptions and things like that so that we can give relief to those folks would be better than trying to readjust the progressive income tax bracket.
My guest today is Chris Powell, the Libertarian Party nominee for Oklahoma governor, as we continue our series of interviews with the candidates vying to be Oklahoma's next governor, and he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Well, before we turn to other matters, I want to ask one more question. As of this date, it looks like the general appropriations in the state for next year will be up about $700 million. What would be your priorities for that additional revenue?
Well, I think, as I've already mentioned, at least some of that has to go to education. We also need to look at fully funding things like drug courts and diversion programs to keep people out of our prison system. The fact that we have the highest incarceration rate in the nation is financially draining, as well as the lives that we damage with that. And we also have a lack of funding for some things like mental health services. So those are some of the things that I would look at using that additional revenue for.
Glad you mentioned criminal justice and corrections. Oklahoma voters on several occasions have passed state questions aimed at criminal justice reforms, but those have never been fully funded or implemented. Would you fund them and implement them fully?
I would definitely seek to do that. And I would go beyond that to do things like seeking to make State Question 780 as it pertains to possession charges, to make that retroactive, try to address rolling back or perhaps even eliminating mandatory minimum sentencing and things like that that are going to keep people out of our prison system that shouldn't be there in the first place, and make it so that we not only, as I said, reduce the financial cost of that, but that we stop ruining lives by putting them into a prison system that they don't belong in, that's just going to make it harder for them when they come out to be productive citizens.
You mentioned State Question 780. As you well know, there are a number of inmates in for nonviolent crimes, which they were convicted when they were felonies. They're now misdemeanors. Mm-hmm. What would you do to take action to get those released? Would you commute their sentence, encourage the Pardon and Parole Board to pardon or parole all of those inmates? What would you do exactly?
Well, definitely we would push the Pardon and Parole Board to send us as many of those as we can possibly get they think should be released. But like I said, making 780 retroactive would be very beneficial, because that would be legislative action that would change those felonies into misdemeanors, and we could act on that without having to go through that process. It would also, I think it should apply to people who have already gotten out of the prison system but are carrying that felony charge around on their record, and it makes it very difficult to get the kind of employment that they might like to have, especially if they're dependent on occupational licensing or something like that. It would bring relief to a great many people in our state, and it would have an economic advantage as part of that.
Now, the Criminal Justice Reform Initiative took basically a lowered incarceration rate, the savings in corrections from a lowered incarceration rate, and returned that to communities for mental health issues and also drug abuse issues, community treatments for both. Would you be in favor of using the money in that way, the savings from a lowered incarceration rate?
Yes, I would. I would certainly favor using the savings from that to help fund some of these diversion and mental health programs that we need to have. You know, we treated things like substance abuse and, in a large measure, mental health as something for the criminal justice system to deal with. And it's much more of a public health issue. So we're using the wrong tool to try to fix these problems and improve the lives of people. So we need to start using the right tool, which is going to be things like mental health programs and counseling and things of that nature, rather than prison cells.
Now, you mentioned our current incarceration rate and looked at the idea of intervention programs and drug courts as a counteractive. You know, a lot of that depends on local courts and local district attorneys to make that happen. What would you do to encourage them in many places where some judges and some DAs are actually antagonistic to that approach? How would you convince them to use those tools?
Well, that's going to be very difficult, and you bring up an excellent point. One of the things that I am trying to do as a libertarian is to grow our party so that we can be a stronger voice in communities throughout the state for individual liberty in opposition to some of the things that are done by the political process. And I think part of that will be to work to educate voters that you can't just cast a ballot for the person who promises to lock up the most people. That's actually quite destructive over time. So it is going to take educating voters about what happens when you have district attorneys and judges who don't care about the cost of incarceration, both financially and in terms of the lives of the people who are put into that system and their families.
Well, this brings up a government funding issue because a lot of times those courts and those DA's office really depend on fines and fees from the criminal justice system to operate those court systems and those offices.
That's certainly true. We have to look at the amount of fees that have been added. There's not just the fines and fees that go to support the courts. We have, since the passage of, say, Question 640, that required the three-fourths majority to increase taxes in the state legislature, the legislature has opted to use a lot of fees to increase revenue for this, that, and the other. Well, again, that's happened since 640 was passed, which was 91 or 92, if memory serves me correctly. So before that, we didn't have a lot of these fees that are in place now. So we can certainly look at rolling back a number of those because they not only don't get collected, we're spending a lot of money to try to collect, a lot more money to try to collect some of these than we're actually getting out of them. But they also put a financial burden on people who have been put in the prison system in addition to the other burdens that that are placed on them that make it difficult to integrate back into society. And so if we're not really collecting the money very well and we're making it harder for people who have had some kind of problem to become productive citizens again, clearly there's a problem with this that we can fix by going back to how it was before when we didn't have so many of these fees.
Well, that means a repeal of State Question 640.
I don't think it, you don't have to repeal anything to get rid of some of these fees that, again, we're not able to collect very well. As far as increasing revenue with taxation, I think this past legislative session shows that if there is sufficient need determined, that you can increase taxes under the 640 requirement. So I'm not for rolling that back, but the purpose was to keep the legislature from adding to their revenue, and the fees are a way that they found around that. So if they want to raise revenue, they need to be persuasive enough to get the three-quarters majority, in my opinion.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about health care. One of the enduring issues is whether the state should be taking the Medicaid expansion. Do you support or are you against the expansion for the working poor?
One of the problems that I see with it is that the people that are in on Medicaid now don't necessarily get the kind of health care that we would like people to have. There's a limited amount of money to provide those services. Certainly, there are programs that for helping people in their homes who are on disability and things like that that are not funded as well as we would like them to be to fully provide those kinds of services, and often people are unable to stay in their homes and they wind up in a facility because of it. So we have a situation with ration care now. If we do the expansion, then we're adding people to the rolls, but we're not getting the full amount of funds to be able to pay for all those people that we're adding. So that's further stretching already rationed care. I think we need to fix the systems that we have before we stretch it even further. That's part of the problem with what happened with the Department of Health, although that crosses a lot of other issues, is that any time there was a program that they wanted to supply, they would work the books any way that they thought they could in order to try to provide it, and it eventually caught up with them. If we go through these expansions because we want people to have things that they don't have, and we get ourselves in further and further trouble, I don't think in the long run that we're really doing ourselves any favors.
Now, a lot of people have looked at the situation with rural hospitals as being an issue of Medicaid expansion. I know you have an idea about how rural hospitals can benefit a couple of issues you've mentioned today. One is more access to mental health services. What's your idea?
Well, there's, and this didn't originate with me, there's this part of the Right on Crime initiative that has been out there for a little while, but using some of the unused or underused space in some of these rural hospitals for mental health programs and rehabilitation programs would help to shore up their financial situation so that we can keep some of these places open that are having difficulties now. So I think that would, that would more efficiently use the resources that we have. That's always a good thing. It would provide those services that are needed and are often needed and hard to get to in rural areas, and it would help shore up our rural hospitals. So I don't know why we haven't done this already. It's a little bit puzzling to me, but it's definitely the way forward.
We have just a couple of minutes left, and before I ask you to make your closing statement, you know, when you hear the term libertarian, a lot of people have a lot of different ideas of what that means. I thought I'd just ask you, in your view, what is the definition of the core state government functions that government definitely should provide for its citizens?
Well, the purpose of government is to protect rights, and that's what I think government should spend most of its energies doing. Now, we do have some things within state government here in Oklahoma that the Constitution says that we'll do. And, of course, I want to abide by that. But protecting rights and sticking to that and not trying to mandate outcomes or dictate a particular cultural approach or anything like that, all of those things are not what government should be doing. Trying to control the economy and to promote one industry or another, those are beyond the scope of what state government should do. State government should stick to making sure that people don't harm each other and then taking care of those specific things that are outlined in the state constitution, like education, making sure that the roads are, and they need some work, making sure that the roads and transportation infrastructure is working as it should, things like that.
Okay. Well, Chris Powell, Election Day is coming right up, November 6th. Why should voters choose you to be the next Oklahoma governor?
Well, I'm a libertarian, and that means that I'm not one of those, not part of one of those two establishment parties, that those are the two parties that have been in power that have brought us to where we are now. A lot of people like to point at the one party that's in the minority now, like to say that the other party has been in control for the last 8 or 10 years. Well, their party was in control before that. We got here by both of them and their actions. As a libertarian, I'm seeking to reduce political control by those two establishment parties that exist solely to increase their own power and put that authority and responsibility back down to the individual so that you can live, work, pray, and play as you see fit, so long as you don't harm others. That's what libertarians are about. That's going to be my guide for everything that I seek to do. And I certainly believe that as someone who works a regular 40-hour-a-week job and has a family and responsibilities with that, that I understand the lives of ordinary Oklahomans in ways that a career politician and a multimillionaire CEO simply can't.
Chris Powell, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
The Libertarian nominee to become Oklahoma's 28th governor, Chris Powell, speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. You can learn more about his campaign at powellforgovernor.com as we continue our series of conversations with the candidates vying to become the next Oklahoma governor. Yesterday, we spoke with Democratic nominee Drew Edmondson, and we've made repeated calls to Kevin Stitt's campaign. We've yet to receive a response. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.